The time is 9 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, The Beloved Community with host John Shuck. Stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Viva Italia on Sunday, November 11th at 7:30 p.m. at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in Portland. The Metropolitan Youth Symphony will be performing Viva Italia. The concert includes Italian works, Rossini's Overture to the Barber of Seville, and Ponchielli's Dance of the Hours from La Gioconda, alongside Italy-inspired compositions by Tchaikovsky and Berlioz. Again, that's Viva Italia on Sunday, November 11th at 7:30 p.m. at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall, 1037 Southwest Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The aftermath of nonviolence is the creation of the beloved community. The aftermath of nonviolence is redemption. The aftermath of nonviolence is reconciliation. The aftermath of violence, however, is bitterness. And this is the thing I'm concerned about. Let us fight passionately and unrelentingly for the goal of justice and freedom. But let's be sure that our hands are clean in the struggle. Let us never fight with falsehood and violence and hate and malice, but always fight with love, so that when the day comes that the walls of segregation have completely crumbled in Montgomery, that we will be able to live with people as our brothers and sisters.
And good morning. This is KBOO. This is The Beloved Community. It's 2 minutes after 9 o'clock. My name is John Shuck, and I have guests this morning, one in the studio with me, Hanan Al-Zubaydi. And on the phone, coming up around the half hour, we're going to get Catherine Shockdom on the phone. She is from the UK, a geopolitical analyst. And the topic today is a topic that I hadn't heard about at all before this year, which is pretty amazing. And yet it is the largest peaceful human gathering on planet Earth, and it has been for some time. It's called Arba'in. And I went on this pilgrimage to Arba'in, which is in Iraq, the city of Karbala, Iraq, the shrine of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And so it was the Battle of Karbala happened 680, I believe, CE, and he and his companions were brutally, cruelly murdered. And this, since then, this journey, this visitation to the Imam in Karbala has been an important part for Muslims, particularly for Shia Muslims, but for other Muslims too, to mourn the loss, the tragedy, the cruelty, and also say, "Here I am," Labek Ya Hussein, to mean as I understood that to be the call that he gave, Hussein gave near on the battlefield, was, "Will there be anyone come to help me?" And so that's a call that has echoed throughout the centuries to all people to call for justice. Hanan, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so glad you're here to help me interpret this. My task I was sponsored by the Husseiniya Islamic Society of Seattle to go on this trip to document it in some way and bring this experience back. And it's like, it's overwhelming because it's like I've just discovered a whole universe. You know, how do you document that?
Yeah.
So I've asked you to be on to kind of help me interpret it. And you are, tell me a little bit about yourself. How did you come to the United States from Iraq?
So my family is actually Iraqi, and they left Iraq in the 90s, and they fled to Saudi Arabia, where I was born in a refugee camp in Saudi Arabia. So I wasn't born in Iraq, but we ended up being settled in the United States when I was 3 years old, and I've been here ever since in Portland, Oregon. So sort of a dual identity there, growing up in the U.S., but also being Iraqi, and getting to go back a few times and see that as well.
And you just graduated from, you just got your master's degree, is
yes,
that right?
Yes, I did, yes.
Congratulations. And what is your master's degree in?
Education, leadership, and policy.
Well, that's good for you, because you were one of the people really instrumental in bringing the Ramadan Tent Project to the United States.
Yeah.
tell us about that.
So the Ramadan Tent Project was an initiative that started in the United Kingdom, and it was something to bring people together during the month of Ramadan across all denominations, across all faith backgrounds, to sort of celebrate the commonalities that we have in a world that seems to be very divisive. And so we wanted to bring that same thing to Portland, and we ended up bringing it. Our first year was actually hosted at your church in the backyard, and it was an incredible event where people from all different backgrounds were there, and they shared a meal during Ramadan.
And so, and then since then, it's happened for 3 years. It was the Muslim Educational Trust, and then last year was the synagogue.
Yes, Neve Shalom.
Neve Shalom.
Yeah.
Is there a plan for 2019?
Well, we're all a bunch of students, so procrastination is our finest trait. So we're still working on it. We're trying to figure it out.
All right. Well, I hope that works out. And congratulations for doing that. That was really an important element. And a lot of people showed up over the course of these 3 years.
They did. Yeah. It was incredible.
So I've been posting on my Facebook page the experience here in Iraq. And you responded on the Facebook page or one post that you said I'm jealous.
Very much so.
But I got to go, and in fact I don't take that lightly, because Muslims, man, this is a faith that's from the very beginning, from generations before, and so for me, kind of an interloper, I have to feel like just kind of coming in and being here, and so that is very humbling for me, especially how warmly I was greeted there.
Yeah.
You know, before I left, people would write on my Facebook page how worried they were. Oh, be safe, do all those kind of thing. But I tell you the truth, while I was there, it was in the United States that letter bombs were being sent out and shootings were happening.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever felt more safe than I was in Iraq. And even though the State Department says don't visit Iraq, I'm not sure if that's a good advice. What do you think?
You know, even when I went in 2015, all my friends were very concerned. They were like, are you sure you're going to be safe and all this stuff? And it made me a little bit nervous going. But when you're there, it's life. Like, you go about your day and it's just so incredible, especially, I mean, you're going through checkpoints and security checks on the regular. So that feeling of not being safe is just, it disappears just being surrounded by so many people with the same goal as you of going to visit. So it all goes away when you're there. I don't know if that's how you felt as well.
Yeah, I was also safe because I went with a tour group. I went with a group called Caravan 72 with Maulana Muhammad Beg, who operates out of Los Angeles. And so he took about 50 of us all together. And so it was, we stayed in a hotel in Karbala, just about maybe a half mile from the shrine of Imam Hussein. And so it was certainly all safe there. But it had been, when you went in 2015, there were still some danger going on. There was still some terrorist activity.
Yeah, there was still threats from ISIS up north. Yeah, as well.
And you know what I learned on this? I didn't realize it, how much it was the Shias and the leader, Imam, is that right, Sistani, who are calling out for people to defend their homelands against the terrorists. Yeah. Do you find that in the United States people don't really understand the differences between the different aspects of Islam or pretenders to Islam?
No, I definitely don't see people really grasping that, especially for like Shia Muslims. The story of Imam Hussein and the story of what happened in Karbala is really instrumental in that fight against ISIS, and it was really the push and the movement behind getting people out there and getting rid of this group in our country. And so here I feel like a lot of times people are associating all Muslims with ISIS and not really quite realizing that, especially for Shia Muslims, like we are probably one of their number one targets, and we're regularly a part of their propaganda. It's something that affects our lives, and especially it was always so frustrating to me because my family in Iraq, my Shia family in Iraq, was more likely to be killed by these people than anyone living here. And so for me, it was always like trying to walk people through that understanding.
So tell me about Iraq. Where did you grow up, and what was our, well? Where were you? I mean, where was your family grow up? Live.
My parents are both from the city of Samawa, so it's a southern city.
And that's near Basra.
Yes.
Right? Okay.
Yeah.
And you had to leave because of another tyrant.
Yeah. My parents actually fled because of Saddam Hussein's regime. My grandfather on my mother's side was killed. And my dad's brother as well.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And so why did Saddam Hussein prevent Shias from walking to Karbala?
You know, a lot of people always have like different insight on this, but I really think that what really scares people about this is just how moving it is and how powerful it is to see millions, literally millions of people walking towards something that teaches them to defy a dictatorship or something oppressive. And if you're an oppressive regime, you're obviously not going to want people to take part in something so empowering and so moving.
So it is, on one level, really a religious quest. I mean, when I was there, that was what people were doing with the group that was coming from the United States. Very spiritual, with prayers and tears and very moving, heart-moving event. So one could say, well, it's all religious. And on one level, I suppose it is. But on the other level, the religion is about honoring, mourning a figure who stood up against tyranny with his very life.
Yeah. Also, I think that it's not just a religious thing. There's a quote that I've always grown up hearing, which is, every day is Ashura, which is the day that Imam Hussein was killed, and every land is Karbala. And when you apply that, you're really looking at the fact that every single day there's oppression going on in every single land. So when you're saying every day is Ashura, every day there are people being oppressed, and every land is Karbala, in every place in the world. And that in and of itself is a statement that applies across all religions. It's not something that's specific to the Shia faith, standing up against oppression. And so it is a religious event, but I think that so many people, as you saw, can pull from that experience and learn from it as well.
Speaking with Hanan Al-Zubaydi, we are talking about Arba'in, an event that drew, according to Al-Ubayt TV, 15 million people to the outskirts of Karbala this year. When I went along the way, people would have all kinds of estimations of how many. So I don't even know how they come up with that number. It's no, I know they count visas, and then they probably do some kind of filming and count how many bodies come every second through the line or something like that. But anyway, the amount of people is overwhelming, and Karbala is what? A million people?
Mm-hmm.
So how, I couldn't figure out, how does it fit? How does Iraq, bottled water, lights going off and on, no sewage system, no traffic lights, how does it happen?
It's a really, truly an example of a miracle, I think. Because when you look at it, you're like, there's no way. I remember when I went, I stood on a chair to sort of get away from the crowd. The shopkeeper gave me a chair, and I could just see, like, it looked like just a sea of people walking and, like, flags. And when you're in it, you don't realize it. But when you're like on the outside standing, you're just like, that's incredible. How is it that, you know, it works? And afterwards, like, people stay behind and they clean the streets, and they're cleaning up after people. And people are just so, I think what makes it work is the people of Iraq giving back to the visitors, places to eat and sleep for free. You know, you probably saw people always begging you to take food from their mokibs, and it's just, I think that's what makes it go.
Yeah, it's all there. People, everything. So if you tried to organize it from a governmental level, it would be chaos.
Yeah.
What I thought was amazing is they're directing people through the various shrines. Rather than have, you know, armed police guards, it's rainbow feather dusters.
Yeah. And they, like, whack you with them to, that's like, right, kind of, yeah, get you to go across. Yeah.
I mean, how beautiful is that? I would love to give rainbow feather dusters to the Portland police.
I agree.
I wanted to allow you to turn the tables and ask me a question. I'm still trying to figure out how to process this. By the way, a little plug. My friend who went with me, Josh Townsley, who is the photographer, we went for the idea of taking a documentary. We're not professionals or anything, but we've come back with something. And so Tuesday night, the 7th, at 7 p.m. on the 13th at Southminster, we will have a conversation about it. And Imam Muhsin Al-Dalami of the Islamic Center of Portland is going to be with me, and you,
yes,
and helping kind of interpret this event for the public, which is invited. But I'm going to allow the tables to be turned and ask you to ask me questions about this.
Okay, so I've been posting on all over Instagram and Snapchat about your journey, so a lot of people were so excited to see that you had gone. I mean, I think the question that I got the most was, what inspired you to go?
What inspired me to go?
Yes.
Yeah. I have been kind of in my own, so I'm 57. I'm a minister, and I'm having in a sense, kind of my own spiritual quest of trying to find out the truth about our world and the injustices of it, and speaking against the oppression, including from my own government, and finding that it takes a great deal of courage and stamina, which I often don't have. And so what I saw as I first started to hear and learn about Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, I was moved, and I wanted to go and learn more and see what this is. And so that was probably the initial thing is part of a spiritual quest. It's also part of an interfaith connection. Mm-hmm. I think that many people... I think of my congregation, but it isn't just them, that we don't know much at all about Islam or about even the situation in Iraq. And that was another part of it with Iraq. After all these years of war and aggression and U.S. involvement has been really struggling for me. So I wanted to go and try to learn the truth and participate in that.
So for me personally, the story of Zainab, alayhi salam, Imam Hussein's sister, was really the most inspiring thing for me. I was wondering what from the story for you was the most inspiring, or what stood out to you the most, or, you know, hit that place in your heart.
I think there's a sense in which the story itself is, it's an historical story, mm-hmm, and a battle that happened, but obviously a one-sided, a lopsided battle of 72 people and against 30,000, mm-hmm, right? But it had as I was experiencing it there with the tour group and with people talking about it, it wasn't just a battle. It's like a cosmic battle between good and evil,
yeah,
and the level of cruelty by Yazid and his army and the incredible courage and grace under fire, we might say, and even compassion for the enemy.
Yes.
That was, I think it was probably, that was the thing, and that Hussein, I'm not sure if I'm remembering this right, but saying at one time, it's just near the time he's about ready to be killed, and he's crying, and they said, why are you crying, right? And well, and he wasn't crying for himself, he certainly could be, or his family, but he was crying for them, for their souls, for what they were about to do.
Yes, yeah.
And I found that to be just at a level of spirituality that is, well, beyond what I have at all or even can conceive. And so that part of it was, I think, was incredibly meaningful to me.
Yeah, there's so many aspects of the story that just stand out and are incredible. And each night there's a commemoration for each of the aspects of the story. So each gets to you in a different way. But I was also wondering, while you were there, I guess generally speaking about, like, what was your experience while you were there? Did you feel like it was positive? Was it overwhelming? Could you, like, dissect that a little bit?
It was positive and it was overwhelming. It was also personally moving. I'll tell you a particular story. We were there, like we said, we were in the hotel in Karbala early. So we got to visit the shrine. So we didn't necessarily do it in order, do the walk and then come. Mm-hmm. So we were able to visit while it wasn't quite as crowded yet,
yeah,
but still quite crowded. And in the shrine of Imam Hussein, you go in and within that there is like the area, kind of a box with a grate, to put it that way, but it where he was murdered, as well as where over the site where he's buried. And then there's another one, that kind of a mass for the 72 mm-hmm. People with him. Well, anyway, you go in and I'm kind of swimming through the bodies. And I put it that way because it isn't a violent pushing. Yeah. It isn't anything like that, but it is. You've got to move with this wave. And I reaching out just to touch the edge of the shrine of where he was buried, and I couldn't quite reach it. My hand is about 2 inches away, and so another hand grabs it and puts it up against it, you know. And I don't know, put this, I'm the whitest guy in the room, okay? So there's my white hand, and then there's this brown hand that put it up, and I looked at him, you know. We just kind of caught our eyes together, and it felt really, as just a sense of connection, of brotherhood, of here I am, this Christian from America who doesn't know anything, I can't know the language, I've been a participant just as an American in this violence against this country, and yet here I am welcomed and received in this incredibly emotional way. So I would say that. I had men hug me with tears, you know. I don't think I've ever been kissed by so many men in scratchy beards. But that experience of being, it was just really, just broke me open.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's just amazing. I was also wondering, what sorts of things do you wish that the community here knew about that trip? And what, because you had mentioned before you left, people constantly asking or being worried about you. What sorts of things do you wish the community here knew?
I wish they would know that one of the things that I learned and continue to know, that it is that whatever this terrorism is out there, it is definitely not the millions of people who come to visit the shrine of Imam Hussein. And that itself would be a wonderful thing to know, that the Shias are very close in my spiritual understanding to my understanding of Christianity as well, of about justice and we're on the same side and we're on the same way. That was given the image of the way to Karbala. We're all going really in one direction, and it's really in light of what is happening in the world that this event is an event of real justice and peace making.
Yes.
That's bigger than anything I've ever been in, and I wish people would go and experience it. And I was welcomed as a non-Muslim. Is that okay, do you think, for you, for non-Muslims to come and participate in something like this?
Of course.
I mean, I've been told that Hussein is bigger than any particular religion.
I mean even in the story, they're the first person that was who fought the battle wasn't even Muslim. He was a Christian man, actually. And so it's not about that. It's not about where you're from. And then also when we were there, between the two shrines of Abbas and Imam Hussein, the people walk through. I have pictures of priests from northern Iraq walking through, holding hands with the Muslim sheikhs, the Sunni and Shia sheikhs, and just walking. And so it really is about more than just faith. It is about justice and how it can connect us and make sure that we sort of return the balance to the world.
I was thinking about how many people were represented, how many countries. I know Catherine Shockdam, who's going to be coming up here in a little bit, wrote about 60 different countries. And I was amazed at all the different places. There are people who walked from Iran, from Egypt, I had heard. I mean, can you imagine? Russia.
Yeah. And then also, like, you know how you went to with a caravan of 70?
Yes.
People go from their different countries as groups. And I remember when I was there, I would see, like, flags. Like, I saw the Afghan flag. I saw the German flag. And that's how people found each other when they got lost in the waves. But it was incredible to see, like, a mass of people and see all these different flags represented of the world all in one place.
And perhaps sometime it'll, I don't think I saw an American flag, you know, I can imagine people might be resistant to that. But on the other hand, I would think that that American flag flying from representing people on behalf of Imam Hussein, I think would be very important. It'd be very important for what the American flag has been flying around in many cases. a contradiction. Tell me about one. We're going to get Catherine on in just a second, but tell me about, you mentioned Zainab as an important figure for you. What is it about Zainab that inspires you?
Well, for those who don't know, Zainab was the sister of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and after he was killed, she sort of takes the caravan of women and children, and she really becomes that sort of savior of the story. It really wouldn't be the story that we know today had she not been there to tell it. And just her incredible, I think oftentimes Muslim women are associated with oppression and being quiet and division. And for me, she just destroys all of those stereotypes. She delivers a speech, one of the most eloquent and incredible speeches, to the man who ordered the killing of her brother, who killed her brother. And just, she's an embodiment of patience and standing up for justice. And she's a woman and she made it happen. And I think that for me, she becomes a role model because of that.
You grew up, you have, as you mentioned, you kind of have two worlds, traditional Iraqi society and America. I know a lot of Western people look right away and they look at the coverings, or they look at, for example, women going through a certain checkpoint or different aspects of the shrine when it's busy. Does it get tiring having to answer those questions? And I'll ask it again. What would you like to say to, what would you like Western women and men to know about women in Islam?
I think that I would like people to know not to just assume and base their assumptions on who I am because of that. There are definitely women who are oppressed, and that's across all boards. That's across all religions and all nationalities. So let's stand up for that and not point fingers and just assume that everybody who chooses to cover their head or not follow a certain faith is oppressed, and that use it to empower people if you do see that sort of thing happening. And for me, just like knowing that I have a voice and I'm going to use it. And so don't try to project any of your stereotypes on me. And just, I have role models in my faith that make me that. So I don't need your saving, essentially.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, Zainab herself, Lady Zainab, really a model for human beings.
Yes. She's incredible.
Regardless, male or female. We are going to take a break. I'm with Hanan Al-Zubaydi. We're going to take a break here for about a minute and a half, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to welcome Catherine Shockdam from the UK. This is The Beloved Community on KBOO.
I will come crawling to you, Hussein. I will come crawling to you, Hussein.
You just have to look at this world, see your lovers are tortured and hurt. They can use their tanks and their guns. We will stand together as one. They can tear us limb from limb, but our souls will say from within, I will come crawling to you, Hussein. I will come crawling to you, Hussein.
They can cut my arms and my legs. come crawling to you, Hussein.
They can put a gun to my head and can threaten to shoot me dead. They can wound me till I'm red. They can try to kill me, and yet with my every remaining breath, with every ounce of strength I possess, I will come crawling to you, Hussein. I will come crawling to you, Hussein.
This is the Beloved Community on KBOO. I'm John Scheck. In the studio with me is Hanan Al-Zubaydi from Portland. And on the phone with me is Catherine Shakhdam. She is a geopolitical analyst and commentator for the Middle East with a special focus on Yemen and the Gulf countries. Catherine Shakhdam has been published across several prominent media outlets, including the Huffington Post, Sputnik, Citizen Truth, Press TV, the New Eastern Outlook, RT, Mint Press, Ayatollah Khomeini's website, Open Democracy, the Foreign Policy Journal, the Duran, American Herald Tribune, and many more. Catherine's been instrumental in breaking media silence over Yemen's war and the tragedy which has befallen the impoverished nation. Catherine Shakhdam, welcome to the Beloved Community.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, I'm so glad you are here. While I was in Iraq, one of the articles you published that I picked up and shared on my Facebook page was called The Great March of Arba'in. And you've also, I have another one here, Millions of Muslims Over 60 Nations Gather to Reject Terror in Iraq. And you may have written some more, but thank you for being with me. Can you tell us a little bit about the experience of Arba'in for you. When did you go or out on this walk?
I went last year, and it was my first time in Iraq, actually, and my first time during the walk. And it was, I think, life-changing in the sense that, you know, it was maybe for the first time I actually saw, you know, this coming together of so many different people and communities united, you know, in this desire to affirm their truth and actually stand for freedom and social justice. And I thought that it was so powerful and so beyond, you know, religion. It had to do, it transcended religions in the sense that it was truly humanity for me coming together, you know, to speak for humanity and in the name of humanity. And I think it's very powerful. And the fact that it happened in Iraq, you know, just a few weeks after the government actually declared victory against Daesh, I thought was, you know, even more powerful and more significant. And I think this is what people need to remember. You know, I think that Arba'in is not talked about enough in the sense that there's a lot of prejudices attached to Shia Islam. I know that Saudi Arabia, for example, has worked a great deal to try to demonize Shia Muslim across the world because of the, you know, the principle that they stand for and the fact that history has been quite difficult in between Sunnis and Shia, and maybe for, you know, a lot of it has to be answered to by Sunni Muslim. They have, you know, they have driven literally, you know, Shia, you know, on the outskirts of society, of the, you know, of everything. They have been, you know, stigmatized, and they have been oppressed and repressed in so many ways that I think it scares a lot of the, I would say, the Islamic world to see this kind of revival. But they need to understand that it's not about sectarianism. It is about, you know, this message that, you know, at the end of the day, you know, whether you're Christian, Jew, Buddhist, atheist, or no matter what is your faith or your belief system, is that we are all people. We are equal in our humanity. And I think this is the message of Arba'in. And this is what touched me profoundly, because I saw it enacted. You know, it's one thing to speak about justice and freedom. It's another to actually see it in action and see people so very dedicated to its truth and the propagation of its message, that it was humbling, truly. And Iraqis have and continue to be amazingly, amazingly welcoming and generous with their time and their efforts. And I think, again, this is something that we don't speak about enough. I mean, we talk about how in the West we're so very lucky and you know, rich in comparison to the rest of the world. And yet we don't really give of ourselves in the way that Iraqis have given their time and their money and their effort and their blood and their sweat. And they do so without any hope of return. They do so for the sake of it. They do so because it makes them feel proud, you know, to be Iraqi and proud to be Shia and proud to be Muslim or proud to be Christian. And, you know, this is who they want to be. They want to be better people for the sake of being better people, not for, you know, they're not waiting for gratitude, they're not waiting for flowers or, you know, crowns to be put on their head. And again, I think that there's a lot to learn there. I think that we should draw, you know, important lessons from Iraqis and their resilience and their willingness to actually maybe not forget, but rise above the pain that they have endured for many decades, to find the better in everybody.
Yeah, I went and as a Christian minister, and I don't know how many times people came up to me, embraced me, glad I was there, but and told me that Hussein was for everyone. And I know on that walk and seeing this, everybody moving in one direction. And I'm really, to me, it was like the Shias really are going to help the world lead us, if we get there at all. It will be this type of leadership leading us towards justice against tyranny, just regardless of the opposition. And I thought that powerful message just really resonated with me.
No, absolutely.
Hanan Al-Zubaydi is with me, Catherine, in the studio. Hanan, do you have a question for Catherine?
I don't think I have a question per se, but I just wanted to say I loved your book.
Which book was that?
The Grand Resistance.
Oh, okay.
I have it. It's all highlighted and underlined. And
well, let's talk about that for a second, because there is a relationship, obviously, isn't there not, between Arbaeen and actual forms of resistance today. Can you tell us about your book, The Grand Resistance, Catherine?
Well, what I wanted to do is, because again, you know, I think, you know, Islam today is very much misunderstood in the sense that, you know, we're trying to summarize, you know, 15 centuries of history and, you know, wars and evolution in you know, the intellectual thoughts of religion, and trying to kind of reduce it down to a caricature. And a lot of the time when people think Islam, they think Saudi Arabia, which is Wahhabism and has nothing to do with Islam. So what I wanted to do, and you know, I have to say, I'm you know, as a Shia 12er, I have a horse in this game, because I am very tired of people, you know, immediately linking me to the likes of Saudi Arabia. And I really wanted to basically tell, you know, tell my truth in my book, but also make people realize that there is another Islam, there is another history behind the history that we have been told, and a lot of the time it's been dismissed because it doesn't fit the particular narrative that Western capitals would like the rest of the world to believe or to follow or to kind of fall into. And I wanted to readdress this history, this very, very difficult history that nobody wants to face, and the fact that many things happened in very early Islamic history that you know, it has been dismissed by Sunni Muslim and Sunni scholars and Sunni leaders for very selfish reasons, is that it didn't fit the right narrative for them and it didn't hold the moral high ground. So I wanted to really look into this and make people understand that, you know, we have been stuck in the cycle of violence because we never have addressed those questions, not honestly. And we always had this fear that we would upset people and that we'd become a sectarian narrative. And I think, you know, for me, it was about having enough courage to tell the truth, maybe my truth, but, you know, this is the truth of, you know, of I think, you know, a part of the community, or at least they will find themselves in my book and some of the ideas that I put forward. And this idea that, you know, for me, Shia Islam remains and always has been about resistance against any form of oppression, not for Shia Muslim, but for everybody. This idea that what God has made free, no one can enslave, and we shouldn't allow anyone to be enslaved. And you know, to stand for the principle of freedom and political self-determination. And it's very important today. And so what I try to do is basically use Islamic history and use, you know, the very, I would say, the archetypes of, you know, those battles and struggles that have literally peppered Islamic history from very early on, and explain why it's still relevant today. Because, you know, we're still facing, for the same reason people go to Arbaeen and remember Ashura and the death of Imam Hussein, it is because to this day, it continues on. This struggle in between, you know, the tyrants of the world and those who want to resist, for the sake of resistance, not for the sake of taking power, but because it is the right thing to do, it is the only thing to do to remain dignified, continues on. If you look at Yemen, if you look at Bahrain, if you look at Iraq and Syria and so many countries across the world. But we understand resistance today as something that has to do, I think it's been attached now to moral relativism, in the sense that if you are, for example, an American or a British or French or German, then you are allowed to speak about political self-determination, to speak about, you know, national security, to speak about sovereignty. Now, if you're sitting somewhere in Lebanon, if you're sitting somewhere in Yemen, then, you know, your desire for sovereignty and desire for political self-determination becomes a crime because it sits against the powers that be. And for me, if we are actually true and honest about standing for democracy, standing for human rights, standing for the idea of political self-determination and sovereignty, then we have to stand on it on principle and accept that even if I don't like, for example, the way that Russia conducts its affair, I have to agree that it is their right to have a particular system of governance within their borders, and it is their right to decide what it is that their country will look like. And I think that we don't give the courtesy to, you know, to the Middle East just because it is the Middle East, and just because I think that imperialism has made it so, and that we continue to leave off the remnants of imperialism. And I think that there's a lot of prejudices there that we failed to address. So I try to kind of, you know, speak all this in my book and talk about resistance and hopefully reinvent it in the way that people will not be scared of it. It's a good thing. America was built on resistance.
Yes.
And, you know, I think that the Middle East has a right to resist against whatever oppression it faces. It's a good thing. People need to be empowered. People have a right to, you know, to decide what their future will look like. They have a right to believe or not to believe. They have a right to be Shia or Sunni or Jew or Buddhist or whatever it is that they want. Just as long as we realize that we have a collective responsibility towards one another. So my freedom should not impede on other people's freedom. But at the same time, my freedom is my freedom, and no one is allowed to touch my freedom.
Catherine Schachtum.
You know, this is what I try to convey.
Catherine Schachtum is on the phone with me from the UK. Hanan Al-Zubaydi is in the studio. This is the Beloved Community. You know, it's been said of another journalist, Caitlin Johnston says a number of times that whoever controls the narrative controls the world. And I want to talk about that narrative because I think the Arba Ayn is really a counter narrative. And that could be why I never read about it or hear about it in the United States. Could you talk a little bit about the media's? Is there a media blackout on Arba Ayn?
Oh, most definitely. I mean, you know, we're talking about the biggest pilgrimage in history, hands down. I'm not talking about, you know, I mean, I'm talking about recorded history. So There is nothing of the like anywhere, and it hasn't happened anywhere, you know, in time. So yeah, we don't talk about it. It should be on CNN, not because it's a religious pilgrimage, but because it's relevant to 20 plus million people. It is, you know, I think it's very telling. Not only of the times, but also telling of this desire that, you know, an entire community of people is willing to actually tell the world that they do believe in you know, in equality and humanity, that they do believe that they are principles that are worth remembering and standing for. And we're talking about big ones. We're not talking about, you know, gender equality. We're talking about freedom and social justice. We're talking about, you know, standing in your truth and not allowing people to abuse their power. That might is not right. You know, that we need to live, you know, by certain moral standards, and that it's okay, and it's our duty to actually defend the oppressed and stand for them, especially when it is difficult, you know. And I think that there's a fear that suddenly, you know, there's been a shift, I think, when it comes to morality. Whereas, you know, the West doesn't hold the moral high ground anymore. And I think there's this fear that suddenly, you know, the underdogs, the Shia, the Muslims, are actually enacting those principles that the West is claiming for itself. And I think there's a fear there that suddenly, you know, this cell that was weaved around people's ears that Muslim and Islam is very, very bad and needs to be somehow reined in doesn't hold when you look at Arba Ayn. That suddenly people will understand that this narrative, you know, of Islamic radicalism is true, but it's true for Saudi Arabia, and that this is actually the front that the United chose, and that, you know, the building up of terror is actually linked to the support that Western capitals have given Saudi Arabia, and has nothing to do with the Islamic world, and that there's now a dichotomy in between the Islam projected by Saudi Arabia, promoted by Saudi Arabia, and the Islam that people are living in the Middle East. Whether they are Sunnis or Shia, you know, Sunnis are just as much to, you know, suffer just as much as Shia Muslim under the yoke of Wahhabism, because their faith has been hijacked. So So in some sense, I think it's worse because their identity has been stolen away from them. As Shia, we know exactly who we are, and we're not under attack. You know, in our identity, we are under attack for who we are. And I think that, you know, it's just as bad for Sunni that it is for us. And people now are coming together. You know, as you talked about earlier in the show, you know, this is not just a pilgrimage for Shia Muslim. It's for everybody, and it's about everybody. And I think that it bothers. If you look as well at the way that things are organized, you know, Karbala is a small city, and it's not built to receive that many people. And yet, somehow, they manage to have more people every year than the Hajj, for example, can actually take. And you're talking about the Saudi kingdom that has all the money in the world to finance all the infrastructure that are needed, and still there are issues during the Hajj. And the Hajj is actually not even welcoming everybody. There are quotas, and it's very stringent. And, you know, some people are actually barred and banned from attending the Hajj. You know, Arabain is open for everybody. I think Iraq, especially given the circumstances, has made tremendous efforts in welcoming everyone, regardless of nationality, regardless of faith, regardless of anything, on the basis that it is their duty to open up their borders so that people could make this experience and could actually understand what it means to be standing together, quite simply, physically. And I think it's more powerful than, you know, any General Assembly at the UN, to be quite honest with you, because again, I think it's humanity enacted. It's a beautiful sight to see people coming together, you know, in friendship. And people are not coming with any bias or prejudices, and there's no expectations other than feel better about yourself by the end of it.
Yeah, and people coming, I mean, walking this, I walked the 50 miles from Najaf to Karbala, but I walked along seeing people with packs on, seeing people walking with, you know, I had my hiking boots or whatever, and they're walking in sandals and barefoot. I mean, it was, and poor people, devastated by poverty and war leading this. And yeah, it wasn't government run. It's run by people with an incredible desire for justice and truth. It seems to me that this is, yeah, I can imagine that the powers that be are really shaking in their boots when they see Arbaeen, and they don't want this news out at all, because it really will expose the truths that are happening. The big lie of Islamophobia, for example, that Muslims caused 9/11, in my opinion, I think is being undercovered by Arbaeen and the resistance in many ways, that people are going to realize that all of these people that we thought are supposed to be moral righteously, like you had said, are in fact not. They are perhaps the Yazids of the world. Would you go as far as to say that the U.S. and the Saudis are the Yazids and the people of Yemen for the Hussein?
Well, I'm going to say that the Saudi for sure. I think that the U.S. is enabling. So I think that the U.S. doesn't care. I think there's you know, it's all about the bottom line. I'm not saying it's better, but I think that the Saudi, by definition, know exactly what it is that they're doing, and they're committing a genocide, as far as I'm concerned. The U.S. is standing by, you know, waiting to see, you know, what's going to happen, and, you know, how they're going to try to use the narrative to their advantage. But the Saudi are definitely, for me, the grand criminal of this world. And yes, they are the Yazid of our time, but they've always been. I mean, the very ideology that they stand on is about, you know, the rejection of everyone that is not them. And they seek to destroy everyone that is not them and to kill them. So, you know, we should be there very, very, very scared indeed, because Islam is not about, you know, destroying the other. It's about empowering, you know, the other and offering equal rights to everybody. Wahhabism is about absolute destruction and annihilation. You know, it's nihilism, you know, brought to an absolute extreme. And yet somehow we are befriending those. For me, I cannot possibly understand it, because it's suicide. It's so dangerous that there are no words to actually describe how insane that is. Because why would you ever befriend people whose, you know, feet are literally drenched in blood and sitting in it and quite, you know, happily swimming in it, and yet we do. So I don't know to which extent we should call, you know, the United States Yazid, the Yazid of our time, but I do definitely think that they have, you know, they have a lot to answer to, and they have a responsibility. But it is our job to actually challenge the United States. We can't really do that with Saudi Arabia because, you know, they are a theocracy, so they don't answer to anybody but themselves. But it is up to us to isolate them enough so that they're not capable of continuing what they're doing. And we need to understand that, you know, ultimately, we are responsible for what transpires into our society, what is being brought into our society. And we're allowing the Saudis to have a great deal of influence, and we shouldn't. So we should stand up. So to some extent, I think that the message of Karbala and Arbaeen and Ashura is, you know, it's still valid. It's relevant today because we have a duty to speak up, and yet we don't do it. But we could, we can. You know, we live in the West. You know, we are capable of actually expressing, you know, our views and not be killed for it. So I think we should speak up louder. Maybe we have a greater responsibility because of this freedom that is being given to us. And people in Iraq actually are putting us to shame because they have suffered a tremendous amount, and they're still speaking up really loudly, and they're not afraid. And I think this is very powerful. They are not afraid because they know that, you know, some victories I've written many times, you know, are not in the present always. You know, it's not about sometimes, you know, victory is actually standing in your own truth and say what is necessary. It's not about necessary, you know, defeating evil. It's speaking up. And, you know, I would like to think that people would want to do that more.
The article by Catherine Schachta, millions of Muslims over 60 nations gather to reject terror in Iraq. And all along the way, every post, between Najaf and Karbala, every 50 meters is a post. And there are about 1,400 of these or so. And I think on every one, there was an image, a picture, a photo of one of the young men, most cases. I'm looking at 19, 18, 20-year-olds. Who had given their lives to fight Daesh and from Iraq. Can you talk a little bit about that type of resistance, Catherine?
Oh, it's the PMU, yes. Well, you know, there's a few things I'd like to say about this because I don't think they're being talked about enough. The first thing is that, you know, against Daesh, we're from, you know, mostly Iraqis. But they were not just Shia Muslim. I mean, you had a lot of Sunni and Christians. I think there were about 4,000 Christian Iraqis, you know, within the militia. It's a large number. So it's not something, you know, people tend to think it was all Shia. It wasn't. So it was really an Iraqi effort. It was a group effort. People understood that it was really resisting evil and that this evil wasn't really making, you know, was not really differentiating, you know, in between Christian, Sunni, or Shia. All they saw were a bunch of apostates that they had to kill. It's important because it really, really shows that it's not about the answer to terrorism wasn't born in sectarianism. It was the answer to sectarianism was actually one of unity. And I think that is very, very important because a lot of the time people are, you know, making the argument that, you know, Shia and Christians are not getting along. It's not true. It's absolutely not true. Of course, there are always people who are thriving on sectarianism, but the essence of the message, you know, of this resistance movement that rose up in Iraq against Daesh was of unity. And this is important. And it continues to this day. So sectarianism, in essence, is dead in Iraq. It doesn't exist anymore. And I would love for people to get over themselves and to stop thinking that the Iraqis are so backwards in their thinking that they're still living, you know, under this umbrella of you are Sunni Shia or Yazidi or whatever it is that you are, because it's not true anymore. You know, they are Iraqis before they are anything else. And I think that they suffered enough to be given the courtesy of their nationalism. They earned it. This is the first point. The second point, I don't think we pay tribute to those brave young people and you know, enough, and women, by the way, because they all suffered. They managed to free their country, you know, of an evil that literally blotted the sky for many, many years, but has actually, you know, poisoned the Islamic world for many decades, if not centuries. You know, this Islamic radicalism, this idea, again, that people need to be put to death if they do not belong to a certain denomination, religious denomination. It's an abomination in itself. And they managed to actually drive it out of their country without any help, by the way. Because, you know, we hear a lot that America had a hand to play in this. Not true. Because if anything, you know, they helped Saudi Arabia. So by extension, they actually fed the monster that fed Daesh. So that's not really helping. So they really did this on their own. And again, you know, after U.S. invasion and decades spent under Saddam Hussein, this is a feat. You're talking about people that have, you know, spent decades and decades under oppression, under sanctions, under absolute despair and poverty, and no hope for a better future. And they still found the strength to actually rise up, pick up their weapons, and actually fight for their children. Because what they fought for was the future of Iraq, and they were willing to die for it. And it takes really brave people to be willing to forfeit their own life, their own future, on the off chance that their children will have one. And for me, this is actual real bravery. And I don't think that we see it a lot. You know, we talk, for example, about, you know, the feat of time long gone, but I think that the Iraqi have, it's not a lesson, I think they have set the standard for everyone to follow, and it's a humbling one. And I don't, again, I don't think that people pay tribute enough to the Iraqi. They did something incredible. They freed themselves from an ideology. This is not an easy task to do. It's easy to kick an army out. It's easy to resist oppression, the oppression of a foreign invasion. It's much more difficult to free yourself from an ideology such as that of Daesh. And they managed to do it. And again, that just, you know, it proves that it's not true that Islam is inherently bad. It's not true that they are, you know, that the entire region is defined by sectarianism. It's, you know, Iraq has proven that beyond a shadow of a doubt. So I think we need to reset the way that we look at the Middle East and Iraq in particular. This is not, you know, where all civilizations come to die. This is where they were born. And I think they just proved that.
Yeah, I was thinking in the sense that this is where visiting Najaf, really, you know, and of the stories of the beginning from the flood to Adam and all of that kind of thing. It really, there's a however we regard those stories, it is the sense the beginning of civilization in Iraqis. If there are anything, they are survivors. And showing the future. We have just about 1 minute, Catherine Shachna, but I wanted, you really broke the silence a lot on what was happening in Yemen. Can you give us, within a minute here, what you see on the future regarding Yemen?
What I see in the future? Well, I'm just hoping that the international community is going to wake up. They seem to be waking up a little bit because they're realizing that they have backed the wrong horse, Saudi Arabia, and that they're not on the side of humanity or history. But the war needs to stop, and we need to stop thinking that it's a civil war, or that, you know, it's anything but a genocide committing by the Saudi against the Yemeni people, because they had the audacity to claim political self-determination. We need to allow the Yemeni to decide what their future will look like, and to stop projecting our political ambitions onto them. Those people have a right to decide what it is that they want and how they want it. It is their country, it is their land. And there is never, ever a justification for the horrors that are being made. Whether it's capitalism, whether it's political ideology, it doesn't really matter. When children are dying and people are made to starve, I think we need to have a really, really good look at ourselves and actually think, you know, is this who we are? Because by definition, what we do make us who we are. And I don't like who we are in Yemen right now.
Catherine Shachtam, thank you for being with me today. She is a geopolitical analyst from the UK. Her website, CatherineShachtam.com. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
And Hanan Al-Zubaydi, thank you for being with me today. And we're going to see you Tuesday night.
Yep.
At Southminster at 7 o'clock. Any last word from about Arbaeen?
Yeah, I just want to say, to remind people that, you know, everyone has an Imam Hussein within them, and to please use that power within you to stand up for justice. As Catherine mentioned, a lot of us aren't facing death, so why not use that power to stand up for justice?
That's how we will end. This is the Beloved Community every second Friday at 9 a.m. on KBOL. I'm John Chuck. Be well.
From thirst these girls are dying, your banner stands. For Abbas it is calling, where are your hands? Where are your hands? To wipe the tears they're crying upon these sands. From thirst these girls are dying, it is cool.
'cause it's the day of judgment. Fires are burning your tent. They cry, holding my...
The time is 10 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up at 10, Valley Views presents part two of its conversation with the Labor Wave podcast on the renters' crisis in Corvallis and beyond. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Digital Divide talks to astrophysicist Jeff Matloff about evidence of alien life, ESP experiments, and how interstellar travel might work. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor